This is Mishmash, a weekly conversation where we try to unjumble an important and sometimes under-the-radar statewide story that affects you. I'm Shayna Roth.
And I'm Zach Orchow.
The judge in the false electors case in Michigan is signaling that she may not bind the case over for trial. On Tuesday, the state attorney general's office rested its case in the preliminary exams, but the judge sounded unconvinced. These are the Republican electors who, according to prosecutors, falsified documents to try to help Donald Trump be named the winner of the 2020 election. Zach, remind us who these so-called false electors are.
So, Shayna, these are the slate of electors who would have cast the state's electoral votes for Trump in 2020 had he won the state of Michigan. Joe Biden won the state by 154,000 votes, but as we know, there was a contingent of Trump supporters who insisted Trump won Michigan, even though all the inquiries and data post-election has since shown Michigan's results were accurate. Their plan was to show up in the Michigan Senate chambers where the Biden electors, as the law dictates, were gathering to cast the state's electoral votes for Biden and declare the votes for Trump instead. Most importantly to this case, most of the Trump electors signed a certificate of votes and sent it to the National Archives.
Now, this is just the preliminary exam phase, not a trial. So the state really just has to show that there is probable cause to believe that these defendants tried to commit fraud. The state says that the defendants knew they were falsely claiming to be the state's duly qualified presidential electors, even though they knew Trump lost the election. And intent is always going to be a tricky thing to show. But again, we are just at the probable cause phase, and usually cases being bound over is more of a formality and kind of like a presentation of evidence than anything else. So what's causing the prosecution concern here?
Well, besides the fact that a loss would be utterly humiliating because you could almost get a ham sandwich bound over to stand trial in Michigan courts,
that's
it seems.
That's what my law professors
that's
always
right.
said.
The lead investigator got completely torched by the judge this week, Judge Kristen Simmons, in what I would call a highly unusual criticism for a judge in the middle of the hearings, said the state's presentation was quote unquote not great, and that the lead investigator's struggle to recall key details was a glaring concern. You know, probable cause is such a low bar to meet, like we were saying, but multiple days of criticism from the judge, while not a decision, does seem very ominous for the prosecution.
Yeah. The other key question for both the prosecution and defense is intent. As we said, that's like a big thing that they need to try and prove here. The electors continue to say they thought their actions were just as a backup in case courts overturned Biden's win. The prosecution insists the electors knew what they were doing, but the lead investigator for the state at one point admitted he didn't have direct evidence of the defendant's state of mind when they signed that certificate.
So most of the hearings, and there's 15 defendants, which is a lot of defendants, concluded Wednesday, but there still are a few more defendants to go. And the judge said she hopes to rule by year's end. Wow, this is dragging on.
No rush. No rush at all. Why the hurry? So we're going to take a short break, but stick around because when we come back, we're talking with former Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly. He is now with the Small Business Association in Michigan, and we talk about issues facing small businesses and what's happening in the legislature. We'll be right back.
New from the Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent, but for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back. Our guest this week is Brian Kelly, president and CEO of the Small Business Association of Michigan. He's also a former lieutenant governor, state representative, and marathoner. Brian, welcome to Mishmash.
Thanks, Zach. Great to be with you today.
So let's start out with this. Tell us about the Small Business Association of Michigan. What is considered a small business? What types of businesses make up SBAMs membership? And what issues uniquely affect small businesses compared to large corporations? Basically, give us the rundown on what you do.
Well, the first thing to understand is that small businesses are really a driver across every single community in our state. And that is really reflected in our membership, which is unusually large. We have about 32,000, more than 32,000 members spread across all 83 counties and every industry you can think of, and also in a bunch of industries you probably never thought of. This is a broad, wide-reaching small business, state-based small business association. And we do business services and also politics. So what people know about are the things that we do within the legislature or the courts and working on rule sets and that sort of thing in the public policy arena. But we also put small business owners together. We do compliance education and best practices, peer-to-peer learning, in addition to things like energy efficiency. We do association management. It's a lot of things in the SBM portfolio. So it's a 55-year-old association, and we're just here for small businesses. So what is a small business? That is somewhat in the eye of the beholder. It also depends on which industry. Some industries, you can have 500 employees, still be considered small, like in manufacturing. In other industries, really, once you get past about 50 employees, you're starting to get pretty big for that industry. But for us, we accept the US SBA, the United States Small Business Administration definition, 500 employees or fewer is how we define it. But most of our members have fewer than 100 employees. And that's really who we're working for day in and day out. And we're involved in every single level of government. Sometimes we get involved in the courts. We're often at work in the legislature, and then how things are implemented within the executive branch. All levels of government that we engage in on behalf of our members.
So there's huge change, of course, this term with the Democrats taking over everything. How would you assess this Democratic government in its first 17 months?
Well, we got off to kind of a rocky start with a few things, business climate issues in the beginning. There was a tax cut that was due to individuals and small business owners. The individual income tax is the main business tax that most small businesses pay. Negating the tax cut through an attempt through the legislature and then essentially doing it through administrative means was something that didn't land very well. Things like business climate issues, like repealing right to work, was problematic as well. But we've also seen some historic investments in education and some movement toward fixing the K-12 system, workforce development, and also community college education, some real things that we're able to get behind, and then some exciting work in childcare as well. So like with anything else, it's a mixed bag where we've seen some progress in some areas, lack of progress in others, and unfortunately some steps back in our overall business competitiveness. But really most of that was centered in the first 6 months or so.
In the 8 years that you were lieutenant governor, state government was under Republican control. It is now currently under Democratic control. How would you say Michigan has changed since the Snyder administration, in your opinion?
Well, I always like to preface a question like this by saying that the Small Business Association of Michigan, is a bipartisan organization, intentionally and strategically bipartisan organization. So we don't necessarily think in partisan terms. We work with both sides of the aisle on a wide range of issues and find allies on both sides of the aisle on different issues. So there have been a few areas where there's been a step back in competitiveness that we've already talked about. There does seem to be a shift now, and I think it's a welcome shift and more of an orientation toward small and medium-sized businesses as being a really important part of Michigan's economy. For a while, it seemed like all the discussion was around what the big players were doing, and so it's a welcome transition here to start focusing more on what's happening on the ground level with our communities. So really have appreciated both the supply and demand work that has been done in the childcare arena to help increase labor force participation, which is a major, major thing that we're focused on, the earned income tax credit, another thing that we were pretty excited about, the idea of rewarding those who are working and making it more worth their while to be in the workforce. Those types of initiatives, there's no silver bullet across the board that gets that fixes the workforce shortages. But those things, these little things incrementally have made a difference. And we see that in the labor force participation rate. While it's still low compared to the nation, we have been kind of clawing our way back from the depths of how low it got during the pandemic.
So you were on Governor Whitmer's Growing Michigan Together Council. Of course, the goal of that was to recommend ways to grow Michigan's population. How would you rate the response from the governor and the legislature to the recommendations? And do you see any momentum, or did this get shoved on a shelf in the Romney building somewhere?
There are a couple of areas where I think there is some energy that might not be totally obvious from the outside. The thing that I liked about the Growing Michigan Together Council recommendations is that they were very non-dramatic and systemic in nature, and not really silver bullet type actions or recommendations. Not like some shiny object, like do this and it will change everything, because there aren't any solutions like that. So the way that I describe it is that if you want to grow, the first step is stop shrinking. And so we really do need to focus on making sure that people that are here are doing as well as they can do. That does require improvement in our K-12 system. And it's slow going. Making improvements in that system is very, very difficult. I'm a part of Launch Michigan, which is a bipartisan multi-sector collaboration between different groups that go all the way from the MEA to SBAM that are really determined to make improvements in a lot of key areas in education that all together would move us into a higher performing state when it comes to education. Funding is a part of that, but it's also things like accountability and transparency, in addition to the profession of teaching, lifting that up more, to connecting it better to post-secondary. There are components of that that are moving forward in different ways. Also, there's a debate happening around community college. How far do you go with community college in that post-high school education that really does mirror or match recommendations coming from the Growing Michigan Together Council that I hope make it into this budget? The key is, though, we need better outcomes from our community college system. So it's not enough to say we're going to increase enrollment, but we have to do it in a way that gives a credible pathway toward more success in that investment. So that's what we like about this whole discussion around population, is that you start with those that you have already here. How can we make sure that more people that have already made Michigan their home are able to contribute and to grow and be successful in the economy here in Michigan? And that'll be the best advertisement for growth in the future.
Should Michigan continue to have an income tax? There's been a movement among some Republicans to get rid of it, and some other states are moving to get rid of theirs.
It really depends on what the other side of that equation is. There's been some discussion with respect to a sales tax based system doing away with the income tax. It would look more like a state like Florida that has higher property and sales taxes but no income tax. I think it really depends on what on the other side of that equation looks like. Michigan does have a flat income tax, which I think is a real strength. So if you're going to have an income tax, having a flat tax is important, because again, it is the main business tax for small businesses. The income tax, the individual income tax, is the main business tax for small businesses. And even when they don't take any money out personally, for most LLCs, S corporations, all those pass-through entities, partnerships, they're taxed at the individual income tax rate. If you had a graduated system, that would hit small businesses harder than anybody. So I would say that our first priority in Michigan today with respect to the income tax is making sure that it stays flat.
You spoke to the Detroit News last month in an editorial saying that the state should not be increasing unemployment benefits. Can you talk to us a bit more about why this is?
We have, relative to the rest of the nation, still low labor force participation in Michigan. We have a lot of statistical evidence that there are way more jobs than people available to fill those jobs today. And also we have an unemployment trust fund that over the course of the pandemic was used less like an insurance policy and more like a social safety net. And so it was, when it was used in that way, it depleted what was one of the most robust and healthy unemployment trust funds. It took it to near zero. And while it has been built up some, it's only about half of what it was pre-pandemic. So number one, we think that the trust fund itself has not recovered to where it was before the pandemic, and we shouldn't be talking about increasing expenditures out of it until it does. And then number two, there's just not justification when it comes to what's happening out there in the economy to expand the number of weeks or the weekly benefit. We'd much, much rather support initiatives that encourage work and people to take take jobs that are available today. That's why the earned income tax credit is something we so strongly supported, and really a very historically large increase in that particular tax credit, and things like childcare and then the wraparound services within Reconnect to just solve problems and people getting back into the workforce and in a way that makes sense for them.
As you know, there's concerns that the maximum weekly unemployment benefit hasn't increased in about 20 years. What about the concern that the value of that maximum benefit has deteriorated because of all of the inflation since that time?
I would say the goal is for people to get to work, get back in the economy. And it would be one thing if the economy was didn't have like jobs available, if it was a scenario where people were diligently searching for work and there just wasn't anything available. We're not in that position today. And that's why I think there's kind of a visceral type reaction among many small business owners that like it's just so difficult to find people. And so the idea of making it easier to not work for longer periods of time, it just doesn't really make sense to those that have to fund the unemployment fund in the first place. Because remember, it is a 100% employer-funded program. And so when you consider that, so you say to the people, hey, you know, you've got jobs, you got jobs open, you can't find people to fill them, but we need you to pay extra assessments, taxes into this trust fund so that we can expand benefits and increase the weekly amount and the duration of those benefits. It's just, that's something that I think is difficult in the current climate, at least. The other thing I'll say is that great work is happening within that department, within the UIA, in terms of building better systems that have built in accountability and accuracy. And I have a lot of confidence in the current leadership of the Unemployment Trust Fund. I think Director Julia Dale is doing a fantastic job. I want to be counted among her biggest fans in the system here. I love the work that's happening there. I think that if you ask the same question a couple years from now, when the system was stronger and had more, and people could have more confidence in it because of the work that they're doing, the new one that will be rolled out over the next year, it might be a different answer at that point. But as we have introduced this question to our members, I would say that it has overall had a very viscerally negative reaction, given the way the system has performed in the last really 10 years, but also the just what's happening in the job market.
Business groups like yours spoke out strongly against the possibility of mandatory paid family leave. What is the argument there?
What was proposed was essentially an unemployment style system. And that was, just that on its own was enough for employers to really have steep concerns. So basically what it says is, hey, employers, you'll be assessed based on your payroll. You'll pay into a public trust fund like you do in the unemployment system. And then if your employees feel that they're entitled to or they need some time off, they wouldn't work it out with their employer. they would go to the government and the government would approve it. And so the employer's only role was just to pay the bill. Just on its face, it's not really a workable system. There also, the proposal that was on the table had a lot of qualifications for paid leave benefits that weren't well defined. It wasn't clear like what they meant. They seemed to be very, very open-ended. And in those sorts of open-ended leave reasons could, depending on how it's interpreted or how it's implemented after the law passes, could vastly, vastly expand the program beyond the definitions that you'd find in the Federal Family Medical Leave Act. And it also applied down to just an entity with just one employee. And so when you consider that if you've got, you know, an operation that has one or two or three employees, and then the government can approve those one or two or three employees to be out long term, it literally has the force or possibility of our smallest businesses. It's just literally putting them out of business. And that's a so these are all things that really are just for smaller operations are much, much more difficult to deal with than big businesses. And I think that's one of the biggest responsibilities that we carry is to say, look, we people say it all the time. People love to say small businesses are the backbone of the economy. They love to present as though they're pro small business. But when you create these scenarios that take away flexibility of small businesses, when you put mandates on top of mandates on top of mandates, it really creates a scenario where you have to be at a pretty big scale in order to deal with this stuff. And it just means fewer small businesses. And fewer small businesses eventually means fewer big businesses too, because almost all big businesses started as small. So we view this as an important time for people to really kind of check whether or not their actions match the rhetoric. Are you a pro small business or not? And creating systems and costs and regulations that put small businesses out of business is obviously problematic for us, but the sort of thing that we think is overall very, very problematic for Michigan's economy. When you consider that over the last 20 years, small businesses have become relatively more important. They were always important, but relatively more important to our economy than their larger counterparts.
So SBAM, as you were saying, has historically tried to take more of a nonpartisan or bipartisan approach. But generally, when you look at the list of endorsements for office, it, on balance, has been more Republicans than Democrats. But what would you like to see happen with, and when I say you, I mean SBAM and you, with the Michigan House of Representatives in this year's elections? It's the only part of state government that's up. And of course, if Republicans were to win control, it would end the Democratic trifecta.
We do not take positions on caucus control. So we make individual decisions on individual races. And those decisions are driven by a committee of small business owners that that are appointed to the Political Action Committee. And those small business owners are representative of across the political spectrum, from very liberal to very conservative. And so we believe it's a very good cross section. One of the main reasons why our association has been able to operate in such a bipartisan fashion for so long is that we evaluate based on objective pro small business criteria, and so we do we actually do have a more even mix than I would say probably most business associations. In terms of support between candidates from different parties. But at the end of the day, you do have to be, first of all, you got to fill out our questionnaire, but there has to be some alignment on issues. And historically, it's been maybe a little easier for Republicans to align on small business issues than Democrats. But we've really seen that start to change. And so there are many people within the legislature that we consider to be strongly pro small business who are Democrats. I mean, that's not an unusual thing to find, something that we're really excited about. And so I do expect that as we move forward into this, into these cycles, you still have to be pro-small business. We can't just endorse in a bipartisan way with nothing to back it up. But what we're finding is more and more Democrats are aligning on small business issues, and we think that's a really positive thing.
Brian, thank you for joining us on Mishmash. So do tell, though, when is the next marathon?
I am doing a marathon. I think it's in September or October. I've signed up for one. I usually do one or two a year. And this one is one. It's kind of a neat one. It goes back and forth across the Mississippi River. It touches three states.
Amazing.
Well, that's impressive. Well, I'm going to stick with my neighborhood 5K and look on an admiration at people like you who pull off the marathons.
Tell you what, Zach, I think probably 5Ks are healthier than marathons really at the end of the day.
All right. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks again to our guest, Brian Calley. We wish him the best of luck in his upcoming marathons. Mishmash is produced by WDET, Detroit's NPR station, in collaboration with Gongwer News Service. Mishmash is hosted and produced by me, Shayna Roth, and Gongwer's Zach Gorchow and Alethea Kasman.
Additional production and editing by Hearns Laguerre Jr. Mixing, mastering, and music by Sam Bobian.
Our digital team is Dave Kim, Sophia Joswiak, and Jenny Sherman. Our news director is Jerome Vaughn, and our podcast manager is David Lyons. As always, if you listen to this podcast and want to support it, you can do so by leaving us a review or comment wherever you listen. You can subscribe or follow us on Spotify, Apple, YouTube, wherever you get your podcasts.
Tell your friends about how much you've learned from Mishmash and send them a link. Learn more about Gongwer News Service at GONGWER.com.
Remember, we're produced by a public radio station, which means we are listener supported. So if you really, really like this podcast, you can support WDET by going to WDET.org/give. We'll talk to you next week.